Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The city of Los Angeles has been called the gang capital of the nation. There are an estimated 450 active gangs, tens of thousands of individual gang members, and thousands of violent gang-related crimes every year. So how does society deal with this? Well, the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world, but the cycle of violence continues. Homeboy Industries believes in true rehabilitation. In 1988, Father Gregory Boyle began the organization, originally called Jobs for a Future. The mission was to give gang members employment opportunities. Today, Homeboy provides education, therapy, job training, and tattoo removal services to former gang members in Los Angeles. It is the largest gang intervention program in the world. And here is a brief clip about what Homeboy does. And this is from Brave New Films, and it starts with Father Gregory Boyle.
We're 30 years in existence here at Homeboy Industries.
We have the largest concentration of gang activity anywhere in the world. There are 120,000 gang members in L.A. County, 1,100 gangs. And now we're the largest gang intervention rehab reentry program on the planet. So 15,000 folks a year walk through our doors.
We always represented an exit ramp off this violent freeway. So it's an illusion that, you know, by locking up more people, that it brings you safety. And whatever benefit there is in that dwarfs in comparison. It has this foreverness about a cycle of damage to kids and to relationships and to marriages and to communities.
I've been to every single prison in California. I've been from Pelican Bay State Prison, Corcoran. I've been to all the higher levels, and then I work my way down to the lower levels. And there's nothing there that helps you rehabilitate.
What if we were to invest in people rather than just try to futilely, mindlessly incarcerate our way out of this problem?
It's an invitation to infuse hope to kids for whom hope is foreign and help heal the damage.
Tattoo removal.
Tattoo removal is a change of life.
The first tattoo that I removed was my gang tattoo. It had been there for so long, but I was ready to do it, and after I'd done it, it felt good. At first, it was kind of like, oh my God, I'm taking this off, but then I was like, yeah, because it's no longer who I am.
I went through all these classes.
Substance abuse classes, the anger management, there was a leadership class.
Legal services.
GED.
Job resource.
Pathways to college.
Domestic violence.
NAAA. Computer lab.
I started taking parenting classes. First, I started taking them because they have free food. And all those tutors that don't give up on you, they want to drill you every morning before you have your coffee. It was real hard.
It's helped me become the father that I always wanted.
The secret sauce here is the place, is the community, is the environment, is the extravagant tenderness that people encounter.
I never thought about a 401k. And he showed me the whole breakdown of a 401k and how you can start saving and everything for the future. But now that you're saying that, yeah, I would like something like that. No wonder this way. 401k, now I'm a homeowner. You know, it's 3 years out after doing 18 years in prison.
You could go hiking? I thought that was for white people.
They get trained in the job while they're. So for instance, you'll look down, you see people in the bakery, or you'll go to a Homeboy recycling or a catering or a cafe. And so they'll get training from those folks who are working in those fields.
I got certified to drive a forklift.
My goal is to be an electrician. And they offer a service for that, a class that helps you with the math part of the test.
And And that is a clip about Homeboy Industries from Brave New Films. To celebrate the 30th anniversary of Homeboy Industries, Allison Fogg Carlson published and authored a beautiful collection of stories and photographs of former gang members who have gone through radical changes. The book is called Walking in Grace, Miracles in a City of Angels. And Allison Fogg Carlson joins us in studio. Hi, Allison. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
This is just a beautiful book.
Oh.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Slam. Slam is a graduate of Homeboy Industries and a student at the Pacific School of Religion pursuing a master's in divinity. Hi, Slam. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Homegirl, for letting me be here.
Yeah, it's great to meet you in person. And thanks for bringing in the love signs, which I'll ask you about later.
Thank you.
Allison, how did you first come to learn about Homeboy Industries?
I met Father Boyle when I was in Hawaii as an invitation from someone as a guest. And I'm not really know what to do in Hawaii. It's not one of my favorite places. So I wasn't connecting with anything. And then I heard that Father Boyle was speaking to this convention. I didn't know a thing about him, but I went to listen to him. And I just had a new vision for this book. I just envisioned former gang members. He actually talks about one man, a little boy at the time, who was beaten up every morning by a pipe by his mother. And I could envision later the scars on his back with a hand holding those scars and quotes of Father Boyle's. So that's how it started in my mind.
Is this something that you spent much time thinking about? We had Father Boyle on a few years ago talking about his incredible book, Tattoos of the Heart. And one, you mentioned the pipe story. One story that I'll never forget is he wrote about a young boy whose parents, after they would smoke cigarettes, they would put the cigarettes mm-hmm. out on the children's arm. And I think what got me the most about that book, it was horrific story after story. And I thought, we don't talk about these things in this society. You know, people commit crimes and you say lock them up. And yet it stops there. What about going deeper to find out what happened to yes. these children?
Right. Well, that's what started me. I was so intrigued by what he was doing. How beautiful and tender Father Boyle was in him of himself. There was no anger to him. And so I was just sort of completely intrigued. I read that book in an hour, I think, on the beaches in Hawaii, and just loved it. Highlighted all my favorite quotes of his. And anyway, then I reached out to Father Boyle, and he invited me down to Homeboy, and that's how it all started.
And why did you decide to put together a photo essay, and what was the process like? Because there are a lot of videos. There's a documentary about Homeboy. This is just beautiful, because when you read the stories, you often wonder, I'd love to see who are these people? Put a face to the name. And I mean, I just think it's a gorgeous book. So many pictures, and we'll talk about some of them, because some of the pictures, especially the young woman with the FU tattoos on her face, that was really striking.
Yeah, and she's such a beautiful girl.
Yeah, but talk about the process involved in
putting
this
together. Well, I didn't actually know, because I assumed that they wouldn't share their stories with me because they wouldn't know who I was, nor would they trust me. I'm not part of that community in any way, shape, or form. And I didn't know if they would want to share their faces or their names or anything. So that's why my first vision was more with the man without the face, with just his hand on his back, and then just using a Father Boyle quote. I spent more and more time down there, and I got more and more trusted. And then I started getting invited into people's homes and to people's birthday parties and people's homes for dinner. And that's how I met Slam, who's here. And we would go out for food and, you know, around Homeboy occasionally and just talk. And I just got really close to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And I think as I gained trust in one, then they shared their trust that I was okay. And so that's how it morphed into what it is today. But I didn't start out thinking it was going to be like this. Mm. I had no idea I was going to hear the stories that I heard. And they're so painful, as you know, so many of them.
Right. And Slam, before we talk about your story, what about the trust that Allison just talked about? Because so many people go in and out of Homeboy. You have amazing mentors and teachers. You have celebrities. I was just watching a video of Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin going into the bakery, and they're big supporters of Homeboy. You have such a wide range of people coming in. But you're also in a vulnerable position of sharing the story. So how do you gain that trust?
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. And I've went to bat for or let me reframe that. The way in which she was introduced to us already came with a lot of credit based on the way that that space operates, as if those whom come there from other spaces that we normally wouldn't feel like we would be connected to come with a sense of honor for the journey that we've all been on. And we've all been on different ways of the journey. But the idea that the homegirl here, and I say that with, you know, one of the things that I want to make sure that I state is that the for me now, in the way that we say it, to say to someone a homeboy or a homegirl is a term of endearment, is a term of appreciation, it's an invitation, almost like this phrase or this philosophy of Ubuntu, the South African notion, I see you and you see me, that together we bring each other into the world. So when I say that to somebody who normally doesn't receive that or doesn't see themselves as that, it's a way for me to say, to embrace the radical kinship, the notion that we belong to each other. So I'm embracing that. So she became a homegirl in many ways, in the sense of how when she was there coming at us and in different ways, that we felt like because of the place provides us with the sense that the people that, because it's also a weird feeling sometimes when you first get there. There's so much going on there. And then when people arrive with all these groups, I mean, there's so much happening when you're there. And if you're there in the program, you're there, and many times by the time you get there in the morning, you're just already tired from just getting there. So much has happened maybe the night before or even that morning or during that week prior. And then you arrive there and you're just sometimes exhausted. And that's why we have the morning thought of the day that kind of rejuvenates our stuff for the rest of the day to get connected. But then folks like Allison will come through and from a whole variety of backgrounds. And then we just, particularly with her, because I was in a poetry writing class. It was a writing class. And she had initially approached me about the poetry stuff that I was writing. And in many ways, it's also a tribute to the way Allison in and of herself is or has been with us. But yeah, definitely the credit all goes to the community of tenderness that we create there, mm-hmm. that allows us to really try to embrace that when someone comes up to us or we are introduced to somebody who is offering their time to us, we want to try to honor that in a way that allows us to receive them, him or her, or they, them or they, as fellow bearers of the image, in my background, of faith, the image of God that we all bear.
You mentioned radical kinship, and this is one of the main mottos of Homeboy Industries. What does radical kinship mean to you?
Well, it's definitely not just a Homeboy Industries platitude. I think sometimes folks will hear that often or hear it in a title of a book or maybe like Boundless Compassion. Pops was great about always, you know, making sure that we are reminded that, or the world is reminded that this is what we're about. But it's not just this platitude that we just want to say something nice to, you know, and, you know, hey, radical kinship is dope. You know, you should belong to me and one another. It's something that both is both a profound and deep and also a pain in the rear sometimes, you know. But to me, it's this invitation to see the other as myself. And I think that's in different levels, that's pretty hard. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a recent trip that me and my son just took, but what it means is for me, based on, because I'm a person of faith and I'm studying a religion at the Pacific School of Religion, and Pops likes to say it's the only thing that mattered to Jesus was that it was this notion that no one does not belong to each other, that if we were to be able to remind ourselves just that together we're connected, then the world would be a different place, and certainly would be for us, because our neighborhoods and the place that we come from, when rivalry rules the day, people die.
Mm. Allison, how has this experience being so connected to the homeboys and the homegirls, and I should say, when Slam says Pops, you're talking about Father G,
yes.
Father Gregory Boyle. He's called Father G and Pops by the homeboys and the homegirls. How did this affect your way of thinking about so many of the issues that we're facing in this country around gangs, crime, poverty, our jail system that is just, as I said, we have the highest incarceration rate in the world, but the cycle of violence continues. I mean, it's a big question, but you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Just how did it change the way you think about these issues?
In many, many ways. I mean, initially, you know, for me, I think a lot of this is just judgment. I think we just throw people in jail for really very little reasons at all. And, I mean, what I was working with was intrigued with was my own transformation at a time in my life and their transformation. But then I sort of grew up in a rather privileged world, and I think I was much more judgmental as a result of that. And one of the beauties that I've learned and come to terms with is just, you know, these people are the tenderest, kindest. They're some of my closest friends. Hmm. And it's really wonderful to watch.
And as someone who grew up in privilege, a white woman, mm-hmm. the majority of the people at Homeboy are people of color.
Right.
How does it affect your views about race and racism?
Well, I grew up in a privileged world, but in a lot of countries.
Okay.
So I lived in Africa, Mexico. So that was never a part of, I've never been considered myself to be racist that way. I just embrace all cultures. I've always embraced all people because I'm kind of intrigued with stories and sort of who I am. But
I didn't mean to imply that you would be racist.
No.
More that the system itself, people of color are affected the most.
Oh, absolutely.
By far.
No question.
When you're talking about poverty, crime, neighborhoods that have been neglected.
Right.
Right.
No, I mean, yeah. And I mean, even yesterday, I picked up Slam. We went to have lunch in Berkeley with his son. And, you know, he's sensitive to it. But I'm very sensitive to it when we go into a restaurant and how they sort of treat him. And then me as well, because I'm with him.
Hmm. What happens?
No, nothing. I mean, I'm pretty good at sort of glaring them down and making them come over and smile and serve us properly. But, you know, it's really interesting to sort of watch that. But coming to the jail issue, I mean, this is a big issue for America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't know. I think awareness gathering, and that's one of the reasons I also wanted to create this book. It was just another awareness venue or tool for Homeboy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just isn't working.
Right.
It's not working, and Homeboy is working.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like, you know, I listened to the interview that you did with Pops, and, you know, generally speaking, it's an overwhelming situation that we're facing right now. I mean, the reality of just the way that, I mean, not only that, but I mean, our youth, there's a line from Tupac in the Ghetto Gospel. They says, we're ashamed of the youth because the truth looks strange. We left them a world that's cursed and it hurts. You know, and sometimes I feel like often what happens is that we shame our youth a lot. Not just homies from the homegirls from the hood, but just generally speaking, we have a hard time trusting that our youth. You know, and in some ways, I feel like, generally speaking, how that trickles down to the folks like from our background and what and come from impoverished neighborhoods or communities of despair. The effort that sometimes is lost is in how do we redeem folks, and how do we not feel like there's a pile of discardedness that we can just place folks over there and feel like the story is really that. But it's an overwhelming fact that the situation is not getting easier for folks. I mean, I often struggle with the reality that if all the poor folks in the U.S. were to rise to middle class level, we would crush the rest of the world. You know, and so sometimes I struggle with what it is that we're trying to do and how we're trying to raise folks to a level of awareness of what is our situation. I mean, you know, classic, you know, seminal work from Mike Davis, you know, The Planet of the Slums, you know, you just think about what the population will look like where we're headed. I mean, and then what that happens is climate change, it's not just a, you know, quote-unquote white issue. It ends up affecting those of us who are most vulnerable. And so explore that question, I do feel like instead of, you know, just incarcerating our way out of the issues, you know, we need to, like Pops says, you know, figure out ways that we can address what's actually at the core of the issue and what that is. And it's, again, it's not a platitude. It's this notion that no kinship, no justice, no kinship, no peace, no kinship, no mutuality. And when we're not in the sense of that we belong to another, and I'll just tell you, you know, we me and my son recently were with the Children's Defense Fund in Tennessee, and that was our first time going to that space, and it was a really a beautiful experience there. We got to meet a lot of interesting folks, felt a lot of acceptance and love, but it was a space that was really unfamiliar to us, and there was a lot of folks. It's in a space where they proudly will, you know, use the Confederate flag and whatnot, and mm-hmm. and that was a little bit off for me. And then one of the things that happened is me and my son were at this restaurant, walking across the street from our restaurant to the hotel that we were staying at, and sure enough, one of those vehicles that had that cruised by, and they just said "F you," and there were, I mean, we were just walking to our you know, and I just, you know, looked like a homie and whatever. And, you know, and I, at the moment, I really wanted, you know, I was walking with my son and walking across the street. And, you know, I felt like it really hit me. You know, I was like, it just took me by surprise, you know. And the part of me was like, you know, man, I really want to go over there and be like, hey, fool, like, you know, do you care to clarify your BS statement? You know, like, you know, what are you trying to do here, homie? Like, because I know that this is a reflective of wounds, right? But my pride was hurt. And it's not like, you know, oh, someone yelling curse words at me driving cars is the worst thing that's ever happened to me, right? But I was really reminded that radical kinship is the pain in the rear, because what it really boils down to is that I cannot, you know, when I went back to the room and my son, he was, you know, he was kind of like, he was a little nervous about it, because it was like, hey, homie, like, we're in this new spot. These people, like, wave this flag like it's nothing. And then, like, here they go, like, you know. Long story short, when we were at the room, I was really processing the experience. And in many ways, you know, and I don't have any, you know, qualms with admitting it, you know, like, I teared up, you know, but I choked up, because I felt like, you know, what about the situation am I really wrestling with? You know, how it's easier, almost way easier, to be back at homeboys, be back in, you know, and in a space where you're in the back and you're in the kitchen, you know, just like that video you were talking about and I know those folks, right? And I worked in the bakery. And, you know, you could be in the bakery where situation will be like, there's a homeboy over here or a homegirl over there, and maybe somebody knows about someone from across the table that someone, you know, blasted someone's cousin or primo or, you know, someone's brother or homegirl got blasted from someone knows something. And in any other space, any other given situation, maybe they would be at each other's throats, but nah, in that space, you know, instead we bake bread. Tú sabes, and like we're right there, and we become become friends with our wounds, and we see each other's wounds, and then we fall in love in the best way possible, in the sense of that we create this community of tenderness. And when I was in Tennessee in that space, I was that started to slip away, you know, and not in a sense where I forget what I'm about, but in the sense I was just like, wow, you know, like, why would these people be like that? You know, I was like, back home, folks would just be like, hey, if you want to say something, go say something in someone's face, you know. But at the same time, it's like, you know, wow, you know, it's unhealth, you know. It's not about hate. Pop says it's not about hate. It's about unhealth, you know. And so I was reminded when I was, you know, tearing up, and my mijo was right there, and it was like, you know, bro, you know, like, I wish I could have, you know, I have these love signs and these love stickers that I bring everywhere. And I was like, but it startled me, you know, because it just felt like it's just out there. It's just so out there that folks forget that we belong to each other. And I'm desperately trying to figure out, how do you constantly keep this at front and center? And it's a pain in the rear, because you want to be able to look for loopholes where you say, well, I don't care about that person's ideology, therefore I don't care about that person, because they're within that ideology. And Pops has had to help me with that, because I sometimes try to look for loopholes. Well, I don't care about their ideology, and so I could honor their you know, image of God that they're made in, and I could honor that they belong to me. But because they're in that ideology, then I don't want to respect that ideology, so therefore I could discard them with that ideology, you know, temporarily speaking. But it doesn't really work that way. Mm-hmm. It gnaws at you. And so I was really checked. I had to check myself, you know, like, I'm about radical kinship, you know. And I say a little bit more about what it means to be from homeboys, because now when people ask me, where are you from, that question carries so much weight, so much, there's so much tension within that question. And for a lot of people, it's just a regular question. Hey, where are you from? But where we come from, it's like, hey, you know, you better let me know something, because the way you answer is going to have everything to do with how I respond to it. And now what we say is, we're just from Homeboy Industries. We're from Bruno Street, where hope lives.
Wow, amazing story, Slam. That is Slam. He is a graduate of Homeboy Industries and a student at the Pacific School of Religion pursuing a master's in divinity. We're also joined today by Allison Fogg Carlson. She's author and publisher of the new photo book, Walking in Grace, Miracles in a City of Angels. And the book is celebrating 30 years of Homeboy Industry and the incredible work that they do, providing therapy, tattoo removal services, job training. In fact, if you're in Los Angeles, you can take a tour of Homeboy Industries and be sure to eat at the Homegirl Cafe. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the incredible work of Homeboy Industries. This is an organization in Los Angeles, and for the last 30 years, they have been working with former gang members. They believe in real rehabilitation, not continuing on this path we're going down in the United States, having the highest incarceration rate in the world. And today we're joined by Slam, who's a graduate of Homeboy Industries. He's a student at the Pacific School of Religion pursuing a master's in divinity. And Allison Fogg Carlson is publisher and author of a beautiful new photo book, photos of people, homeboys and homegirls, and their stories. It's called Walking in Grace, Miracles in a City of Angels. And all proceeds from this book will go to Homeboy Industries. Before we move on, Slam, is there anything else you wanted to mention just about the experience you shared there?
Yeah, you know, generally speaking, I want to just say that I'm always on non-center speak mode, and more and more these days, which is to say that I'm always practicing how I would try to say this or declare this to the other homegirls or homies. You know, and I know that we're on live and we're broadcasting and whatnot, but I really feel like in many ways my heart is always constantly in, we speak from the margins, right? So we stand with the demonized so that they will come when we stop throwing people away, and we look down at when we're at the margins and they become erased because we're there with others, right? And so in many ways I feel like my invitation, and maybe I might say my calling, is to fight for a way to that, always kind of in some ways speak real about the situation. So make no mistake about it, we're transforming people, you know, and we're studying up about where we were headed, because we're just so delighted about the invitation to be there with the Children's Defense Fund. And me and my son did a presentation. We talked all week about Homeboy Industries, radical kinship, and all that stuff. But yeah, we the night before we were at, we had just arrived and we went to the Walmart, and there was like no people of color there, you know, and there was folks wearing, you know, Confederate flag hats, and we're just in a different environment mm-hmm. there. And I feel like it caught me off guard in many ways, because, you know, this is not just something that I just am trying to like put together so I sound good to people. You know, this is stuff that's saving my life every day. You know, and so to wrestle with this stuff is really where folks are. You know, we become transformed people not because overnight it's just, you know, you download this stuff into your brain and all of a sudden it's there. We become transformed people because we do the work. And then me describing that situation to you is an example of doing the work. And then I say it's sometimes easier for me now at Homeboys in hindsight. But when I was there, I mean, it was a struggle to, like, what does it mean to do the work, mm-hmm. right? And so I imagine in that situation telling the story to a homegirl or homeboy and being like, when you're in the block, when you're headed this way, when your homies or homegirls are spaying, like, yo, let's go throw it down over here, remind yourself that you belong to a space now in which we don't look at stuff that way, you know? And so sharing that story in many ways for me is a reminder of how to be real about what it means to do the work in all spaces. I think a lot of times folks will do that internal investigation on their own, generally speaking, but feel like it's not, you know, right to share that. And I feel like it's a shame not to share that, because, you know, people will chart that, chalk it up into their mind and in their heart in ways they'll simmer unless you let it out and say, look in ways that we need to constantly embrace this notion that nobody is outside. Like even the folks who do mass murders, you know, like even the folks that, you know, we want to, not just for the sake of being like, oh, it's not a kumbaya moment. This radical kinship notion is not, let's all hold hands and pretend that, you know, the world's a better place if we just get along. Mm-hmm. It's this notion that when we recognize we belong to each other, we want these systemic issues to no longer happen, because we care about the person that is informing and affecting desperately.
Allison, you tell so many stories of homeboys and homegirls, and just hearing Slam talking about transformation and doing the hard work, what really struck you, or still strikes you, about all of the homeboys and the homegirls that you've met? You said that they've welcomed you into their homes and their families. What strikes you about the hard work that they do and the transformations that they go through?
I find it so impressive. I'm always being asked, am I frightened when I go down to be with them? And I'm never, ever frightened.
People ask you that.
Mm-hmm. And I'm never. The only time I was ever frightened was the very first time I went to Homeboy, and the lobby even is just nothing but glass, and there's lots of chairs for people, and mostly gang members are waiting to have an audience with Father Boyle because they want to get into the program.
Right.
And then there was me, and then everyone's distracted by the CNN TV. That was the only time I was ever frightened, because I was just frightened to meet Father Boyle and discuss what I was thinking of doing and so on and so forth. But no, I mean, they're just remarkable people who are constantly going through, as Slam said, it's a constant daily event. Mm-hmm. What they do, their transformation is just constant. And they're constantly reminded of the fact they still have a lot of work to do. But so I've just find them so, I mean, I'm just in awe when I'm with them and talking with them, because they're all like Slam. And I find also a lot of them just need to talk. They talk a lot. They share their stories. Once they feel comfortable and they trust you, then they just talk and share, because no one probably has listened to them very much in life. And, you know, now they have something to say. Mm. And they rattle on and on and on. And so
you're reminding me of a story that Father G either told on the show or that he shared in his book. And he said that in some cases, in the case of the young men who don't really have fathers in their lives, or in some cases moms, Father G will call them son. Mm-hmm. And he said that there have been so many times in the middle of the night that they would call him on the phone and say, Father G, you're calling me son. Does that mean that you're my dad? Mm-hmm. And he says, you know what? You can call me that. Yes. And it's like they just want love.
Yes.
I mean, he said sometimes out in society, you'd see a big guy with a ton of tattoos, and this is the guy that walks in his office crying, and they just want a hug.
Yeah. And he hugs. I mean, Father Boyle just spends, as you know, his whole day hugging. It's a wonderful thing. He really is incredible. They all call him Pops, Dad, as you know, all sorts of things. I call him G, mm-hmm. and he calls me kiddo. I don't know what that means.
What about that, Slam? I mean, again, we'll talk about your story in a minute, but what about that, just the love that so many of these young people desire and crave, and then they find it, I mean, obviously from Father G, but all of you also, and the support that you get.
Yeah, Pops likes to talk in his books definitely about the fact that you don't go to the margins to save folks, to reach folks, but you go there to be saved and to be reached by folks. You know, and so in many ways, I feel like the love that we encounter, not just with him, but in this space, is in fact this reciprocal, circular type of an energy space that is really, you know, I like to say, well, my name is actually Sam, I like to say that the L is for love, you know, and it just so happens that it makes L.A. in the middle.
And I should say, when we met each other before the show, Slam brought in these basically, do you want to describe this? It's a piece of paper. It says Homeboy Industries and then love, and the O is a heart. Yeah. And then he also put a sticker that says love on my shirt.
Yeah, well, so basically this, it's been a kind of an experiment between me and my son. So I'm a single father and I'm raising my son. There was a time when I wasn't in his life, And now I am in his life, and he's kind of was the reason that allowed, allowed me to be able to keep pushing through. But one of the things that we've been experimenting with is this, I call it nonviolent graffiti, because in many ways it's a piece of paper, and in many ways it's so kind of like, cheesy, I would say, in many ways, because it just says love, right? But the letters are a particular type of font, and they're usually associated with gangster letters. And just a word on the gangster letters, if you do any research about where the origins of some of the graffiti, gangster graffiti, comes from and whatnot, back in the day when, a lot of the lettering that comes from that would be Old English. Old English is very identifiable as a font type that folks would use for, gang stuff and whatnot. But the behind of that is that the gang lettering in the Old English would really be a symbolism, because folks were looking for a way to find significance. And things like the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times, or like these are things that are of prominence and significance in Old English. Like you think of documentations that you would get, the Constitution in Old English, or your graduation diploma, or, all these certifications, things that had prominence and significance were done in Old English. And so, long story short, gangs would utilize that to try to, of folks who are not significant, maybe use that to find some significance. That all I say all that to say is that one of our ways of trying to find kinship with some of our stories, because see, what ends up happening is sometimes folks would look at this love poster and say, why would you use that kind of lettering? And this is a different, this is not Old English, this is a different font type, but it's artistry, right? And it stems from that, because folks would then take it and develop it in different ways. But they would say, why would you, that looks so like evil, or maybe it's filled with hate, because they associate that with other things. And I say to them, there's twofold. One, it's a way for me and my son to practice finding kinship with our stories, not just with our stories, but with the struggle in our neighborhoods or places in our community where our people that are from homeboy industries come from that are riddled with gang graffiti, maybe in some spaces that sometimes if people get crossed out, that's a reason for sometimes violence to occur and ensue. And one of the things that we were imagining, what would it be like if the world was filled instead, our neighborhoods were filled with love tags instead of just all these neighborhood tags that, but it became more than that, because we didn't want to say, oh, look how neat, the gang member would like for his neighborhood to be tagged up with love, versus all these other neighborhoods. Like, no, bro, that's not what it's about, homie. It's not about this, like, oh, it's not that. It's far deeper than that, because we started to realize, and I have these conversations with my son, that we live in a world that is constantly coming at you with all kinds of statements and phrases vying for your attention. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are anything but inviting you to have an experience of love. And so we're trying, it's an invitation to try to be prophetic, to try to think through what it might mean for our world, not just in our neighborhoods, but our world, to embrace that. Because it's not just holding hands kumbaya stuff, but it's really this notion that kindness really is the only strength there is, and love really can do some powerful things when folks really embrace it. Mm-hmm. And so we put these up and we talk about these, and it's a way for us to tell our story, but it's also a way for us to startle people from, and that's what the love stickers are for. I was telling you, on the BART or there's places, like when folks aren't realizing, I'll give them a love sticker, or if someone does something kind to me, I'll say, here, thank you for your kindness, I'll give them a love sticker, or I'll like sneak love stickers on people's backs or stuff like that without them knowing, and someone else will see me, and they'll think that maybe that fool was about to just rob that person or something, and instead they see me putting a love sticker there, and they're so dumbfounded, because I'm the least likely person that they might think of that. And in many ways it just makes me think of all the people that back home who, and in the book, I mean, this, we're delighted that we're part of the stories in the book, but all the other people in the book, they're our heroes. Mm. And it makes me choke up now, because those folks, man, like not just them in the book, but all the other people there, we borrow their courage. Me and my son, we borrow their courage so that we can keep pushing through, because if it wasn't for them. And it's funny when Alex was talking about, like, I was scared when I first went to Homeboys too. Like, when you go there and you're thinking, oh man, I'm gonna make this decision, I hope they really accept me, and you go out and you see all these homies out there and you're not sure what to expect, and all these homegirls, and they're all piled up outside, and you just think, man, am I in the wrong spot? You know, like, what, you know they're from rival stuff, and you think, but, and then you just walk through those doors, and all of a sudden, it's like, you're home. Mm. You know, and so this love stuff is really just a way to say there's home for more folks than they realize.
I want to make sure that we don't end the show without talking a little bit about your story, Slam. In the story, Walking in Grace, you write about, or Allison writes about you, and you tell her about being raised within the system of incarceration since pre-adolescence. I knew that it would only be a matter of time before I would self-sabotage and eventually find my way back to the streets and incarceration, on my way to the inevitable ending of the certainty of death. Despair had become my soulmate.
Yeah. Well, in all fairness, that she gave me the, she asked me if I wanted to write my own. Mm. So I was, hesitant about doing that. So I wrote that piece. Definitely. I mean, I tell folks, our stories have stories. And even our stories have stories. Like, even just imagine for a moment, you have a story in your life that you have that you'd share with people, and then you've been telling yourself that story for a certain way for a certain amount of time, and it informs you. And then you come across someone else who was there, and then you're like, remember this, remember that? And they're like, hey, that didn't happen that way. I was there too. Remember this part? They're like, oh, snap. I've been telling it the whole, and you realize your stories have stories. And I say that because in many ways, part of my where I start my story now is really just at Homeboy Industries. Mm. I really start my story there, and I do so in a way where I feel like my son, who's for God bless him, he didn't have to stick with me, but it really, my story at Homeboy Industries stems from the fact that I was about to give him up, go back into the life, go back to the streets, go back to the gang stuff, because I really felt like there was nothing left for me. I really felt like I didn't have any place to be, anything to offer the world. I couldn't find any employment. My son was back in my life, and I was trying to hold on to him desperately, and I couldn't figure it out. And we were shuffling around from spot to spot to try to figure out how we could manage, and I just couldn't figure out. And I just thought, man, this kid's so much better off without me. The temptation is, if you're going to be with me, fool, like, I'm just going to put you on the block with me, dog, and you better make some fetty, homie, because otherwise, why are you here, bro? And if I'm going to be doing this, you're going to be doing it with me, dog, and I'm going to let you know how to do it, bro, because otherwise, I'm not helping you out if I don't let you know how to survive, and that's what I'm going to teach you. But I didn't want to go through that. And so I was going to let him go, the family, the system, whatever, and that's when I went to Homeboys. And when I went to Homeboys, it was like a breath of, I could breathe again.
Wow, that's an incredible. How old is your son now?
He just turned 13. Yeah, and so, getting him through the 12 years old was an important part, because I started getting arrested at that time. And I wanted him, and now, since he's, in his teens, I tell him, like, now it's a 7-year plan, right? Till you get to 20, you're still in a teenager, technically, even though you're 18, 19. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we figure out to continue this bond that we have? Mm-hmm.
And in the book, you say that obviously some days are better than others. Can you talk about that? Like, when you talk about the importance of your son, and that's what kind of got you to make a different choice. But when you have those days, what is it that keeps you going?
Yeah, I think, in generally speaking, I feel like it's an important thing to try to bring the realness to the situation. Mm. I feel like it's important because we're a hard sell. Homeboy Industries are those of us who are a hard sell. Folks really want to sometimes feel like, folks who haven't messed up really are the ones who need the chance, not the ones who have. Hmm. And, that's not the boundless compassion that we're invited to there. So in many ways, when I say that, is it's really about trying to invite folks to realize that, this is... What sometimes I feel like is the impression that I get from folks, or the sense that I feel like the society wants, is that, okay, never mess up ever again. Mm. And that's true. We don't need to commit crimes. We don't need to go back to the lifestyle. But we struggle daily on what it means to exist in this world. We're not toppled by regular things, but we still have, good days and bad days, like any other regular person.
Right.
And that's what I think is the gist of that. Like, there are some days are better than others. And some days that just means, like, you know, you have struggle putting, you know, in the interview you were talking with Popsy, you were talking about a homie who was in San Bernardino trying to make it work, and you know, he couldn't figure it out, and he was traveling, you know, he left the city so he could be on the outskirts and whatnot. So there's still struggle, and when you go out there, like, you asked me earlier, I'm so conscious of folks constantly, like, I'm the, you know, the person who doesn't fit in the space, or, you know, and whatnot, you know, and some days it helps.
Do you mind me telling people? So Slam has tattoos kind of up to his neck, and then I was wondering about the tattoos on your eyelids.
Yeah, so the tattoos on my eyelids, well, technically that says Chuy Cristo. And the story behind that is one time when I was locked up, a homie was locked up with me, and he had tattooed on his eyelids Second Chances. Mm. And we were both in there and for different reasons, and it was kind of like we're kicking it, and he had asked me, you know, do you think, because he knew that I was wrestling with religion and whatnot, and he had asked me if, you know, if I thought Jesus cared about us homies and stuff, and I said, well, I don't know if the homie, if he does, it's only because he's one of us. And the reason was that because he had gotten that Second Chances tattooed on his eyelids, and he had showed me all of his, you know, we all have stories, right? And so he was telling me his, and one of his stories was about how he got left for dead by a rival gang, and he had showed me all the scars on his body about how they had just, you know, shanked him, stabbed him a whole bunch, and left him for dead, and that he felt like he had gotten a second chance. And it was kind of like this inside joke, like, well, look where we're at, you know, how are we doing with those second chances, because we're both locked up right now. But it led me on this path to explore what it means to follow. And again, I'm a person of faith. I'm at the Pacific School of Religion studying theology. But it really got me kicked on this notion of the homie Christ. I really liked Tupac's Black Jesus. And I was looking for maybe like a brown Jesus because of that conversation with him. And really from before, but that really prompted it. And so, like, when you grow up, you know, the Latino people, they're a mass. We have a sea of children named after Jesus, you know, so Jesus is running everywhere. So when you're a homie and you come up in the neighborhood and your name is Jesus, you know, usually they'll give you a nickname like Chuco or Chuy. And so most common in my space was Chuy. So Chuy Cristo is another way to say the homie Christ. Mm. And so that developed into a space of trying to embrace this image of a faith that invites us nearer. And rekindles our flame from within, rather than pushes us and further discards us. Like so many of the, you know, images of Jesus out there that maybe would say, you know, you're going to a place that Jesus doesn't want you to be, versus like invite you. So that's what that's from. But I got it all. I'm all over my body stuff.
Allison, I wanted to ask you just quickly about Joanna, this beautiful young woman with just her. You want to hang out with her. She looks so kind and sweet. And she's got the words F-U written right under her eyes. And when I first learned about your book, that image just stopped me in my tracks. I mean, the first thing I thought of is, wow, what is her story? I mean, the smile and then F-U.
And the zip code on her chin.
The zip code. Okay, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so, and she is truly, I mean, she's just stunningly beautiful. And her skin is flawless. She also has a little girl. They often, it really helps in some ways for them to heal because they have a reason to keep going forward. Mm. Joanna is without question the happiest person, I think, at Homeboy. And she's the prankster. She's always doing things to everyone else. she's funny. She makes everyone laugh. And she's the executive assistant to the CEO. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So she's back in school. She wants to be a lawyer. So, you know, she's trying really hard.
That's amazing.
Well, a lot of them want to be lawyers because the system's not done very much for them. So
it's something
they want to do. And usually a lot of them want to do things to help other homies. You know, like Alicia was offered, a job with at Bouchon with Thomas Keller, and she turned it down because she wanted to go back to Homeboy, having gone through the internship for months, and said, no, my home is at the cafe, and I want to help other girls that are coming in off the streets, and they need to do that.
I wish we had another hour. I just want to ask you both, when you think about political priorities and where the government spends money, I was so struck when Father G came on last time and said they had a really hard time making basically paying their bills mm-hmm. because they had to do fundraiser after fundraiser. And in my mind, this is a no-brainer. This should be funded by taxpayer dollars. This should be – and there are other great groups, Youth Alive, we're going to have some of those members on in a few weeks. But Homeboy should be in every major city across this country. Can you talk just quickly, Slam, about, you know, how the priorities – are kind of backward, very backwards in this country. And if we did put money into these organizations, the change that it does is already creating, but even more change would be just amazing.
Yeah, I definitely would direct folks back to the broadcast that you had with Pops.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just on point. That's a hard sell, and folks really want to be about new stuff. And
even also, I mean, we'd love to have you back because I'd love to talk about what other resources are available in some of these neighborhoods. Right? I mean, has it changed in the last 20 years?
Yeah.
And what could happen if just a community center, something, was available for young people?
Of course, definitely.
Quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, they're going global. I mean,
Homeboy is going global?
They're in some, I think, Sweden and Ireland.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, they are trying the prototype to sort of take this to other communities. I mean, in America as well.
Right.
But nothing's as successful as Homeboy.
Yeah. And what your thoughts on that, Allison?
Yeah, I think it's amazing. I mean, you know, I was just in London and they don't have guns there, but there's so many knife stabbings. I mean, it's just incredible. Mm-hmm. That's what gangs have. Mm-hmm. So it's different, but it all looks different in a different territory.
But.
And the global is the Global Homeboy Network. We partner with folks across the globe who want to kind of hang out and see how we can help them process the ways that they might do what they're doing in their spaces.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. Slam is a graduate of Homeboy Industries and a student at the Pacific School of Religion pursuing a master's in divinity. Allison Fogg Carlson is author of the beautiful new photo book, Walking in Grace, Miracles in a City of Angels. All proceeds will go to Homeboy Industries. Slam and Allison, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose, for
having
us.
Thank you so much. And thanks to Shireen Adel for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.